Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. How are we supposed to talk about diversity now? As DEI programs across the country get shut down and personnel fired or reassigned, a chilling effect is sweeping the country. Companies and universities are canceling their initiatives, concerned about running afoul of the president's executive order, and waiting and watching for what happens next. Here in Ohio, a sweeping higher ed bill is moving through the legislature. It would eliminate DEI efforts and change the way universities can instruct students on certain subjects. Which leaves us to wonder, is diversity a forbidden topic now? Here to start our conversation is Denise Hamilton, a DEI expert and founder and CEO of Watch Her Work. Her book is titled Indivisible, How to Forge Our Differences into a Stronger Future. Welcome to All Sides, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've helped hundreds of companies and schools and nonprofits put diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives into practice. So let's start by quickly just talking about the terminology, because some of these words have become very loaded. So from your viewpoint, how do you define diversity?
I think this is a really powerful question because this is, in fact, the problem, right? I can tell you what my definition is, but the reality is that doesn't really matter. What matters is the fact that the terms have been bastardized. They've been changed and altered to and converted into basically a slur. So the way language is constructed is it's shared meaning across a broad swath of people. And so as we see these terms diluted and weaponized, we don't have a shared understanding of what any of these terms mean right now. So I know what I mean when I use the terms diversity, equity, and inclusion. I mean removing unnecessary barriers so that the best, most talented people get to do the jobs and the roles and the opportunities that they're best suited for. So how do we remove anything that gets in the way of human genius being added to the fray, being added to the soup? I'm a deep believer in the gifts and the talents of human beings. And I think that talent is equally distributed, but the opportunity is not. So when I think about diversity, equity, and inclusion from the perspective of business, we want the best dancers to be dancing. We want the best singers to be singing. And so anything that gets in the way of that has got to go. So this season that we're in is actually really surreal for me.
I can imagine. I mean, you've made your business in doing DEI work for companies. Can you give us an example of some work that you've done for a company or an organization? One thing that you write is that DEI is not PR. It's not public relations.
Oh my goodness. I wish I could scream that from the rooftop. And quite frankly, what we're seeing in the rollbacks is that a lot of companies did approach it as public relations. It was just PR. It wasn't a deeply held value. I believe inclusion is a value, right? It's so funny. Someone sent me a picture of a company painting over. They had a mural of all of their values, and it was character, integrity, compassion, diversity, inclusion. And I was really struck but as they were painting over their mural, the values that they had to give up to get rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion. The image was so powerful, the juxtaposition, right? I think that the people that have hired me have been really focused on figuring out how to create equitable environments within their organizations and having an attunement to that, learning how to listen for the echoes, listen for the hangovers of previous decades, practices that we do kind of on autopilot. I think that very often we ascribe a ton of malice in these spaces. And sometimes it's just, you know, Xeroxing what we did last year and the year before and the year before. I just aged myself by saying Xerox.
Xerox, yeah.
But this idea that, you know, we've been doing something for so long that it feels like the way. And so my job is to open up the aperture and say, well, are there other ways? Can we consider ways that the practices that we have may be excluding certain groups of people? You know, a simple example is where you recruit. You know, there are companies that won't even recruit from schools unless they're on this short list. Well, how do you get into that short list of schools. And like when you go backwards, you see you're excluding really incredible talent that might be a fantastic addition to your workforce, but you're not even giving them a chance. They're not even getting an interview. So I see my role as supporting leaders in figuring out where the opportunities are to open up that aperture and to let more talent in. We all know the statistics, right? Homogeneous groups make faster decisions and they're happier with them. So that is efficiency and morale. That's hard to beat. But notice I didn't say they make the best decisions. We know all of the studies tell us that diverse groups make better decisions. And that makes sense. If you are running a company for women's products, but you don't have any women on the board, like, or you don't have any women in decision-making roles, it's hard to believe that you're going to make the best possible decisions. So to me, this work is about the business imperative, creating a culture that allows great decision making, great teams, and great ideas to both be lifted up and also enacted.
In the past 5 years, those words, diversity, equity, and inclusion, have gone to from being empowering to certain groups to now being used as like a shorthand for an unfair advantage to groups in the minority. What do you make of this like national changing in our view of these words? I mean, because they are just words.
They are just words. And I'll be honest with you, I have a little grief about it. It's deeply saddening. I think that any effort is subject to criticism. There is no effort that is above criticism. And I have my own criticisms. You shared one, like when people use DEI as PR, right? I have my criticisms of the space. But here's the difference. Let's say you are diagnosed with cancer. Right? Hopefully, they'll be able to give you chemotherapy, a treatment, so that you can defeat that cancer. It's going to be uncomfortable. You're not going to enjoy it. You may even hate it. But the truth of the matter is, you have to hate the cancer more. What I'm seeing right now is not a slew of suggestions as to how can we make this work better? How can we refine it? How can we create different policies and procedures? How can we make sure that we're not creating any unintended harm? That's not the suggestion that I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is let's not treat the cancer. And we all agree that it's a problem. I know, I'm sure of that for myself. Why? Because I heard all the speeches. After the brutal murder of George Floyd laid bare the inequity of treatment of specifically African Americans in the United States, everybody did a speech. Everybody stood up and said, "These are my values. We value diversity. We value all." I heard them all. We can pull up all the quotes and the sound bites. So what we're saying is we all agree that there's a problem. But in this season, we're saying we're just not going to do anything about it. And that is wild to me. That doesn't make any sense. And also, I will say this, I don't think it's going to work. Diversity is not negotiable. We live in a diverse nation. That's like saying, I don't believe in gravity. Gravity believes in you. So you
We're
don't.
all impacted by it,
We're
yes.
all going to be impacted by it. We're all going to experience it. So the question is, are we going to optimize our approach to it? Are we going to lean in and figure out the best ways to animate our interactions? Or are we just going to return to what we all have agreed is unacceptable? And so it's very strange because people often ask me to defend DEI. And I kind of push back and I say, no. Why don't you defend homogeneous, inequitable exclusion? Because that's what we're talking about. If we want to go back to a slate where everybody in the leadership team looks the same and only certain people get opportunities, I just can't imagine a way that we can go back to that and that we would even want that. So actually, this is a surreal time for me.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking about DEI programs and the changing way we all will discuss diversity in the future with Denise Hamilton, a DEI expert and the CEO of Watch Her Work. Her book is Indivisible: How to Forge Our Differences into a Stronger Future. Now, have the companies that you have worked with over the past few years creating DEI programs, have they emailed you, called you, said, what do we do now?
Yes. Yes.
And what do you tell them?
I'll have to say it's a mixed bag, but I am incredibly encouraged. Because people are not really great leaders who are always serious about this work are trying to figure out how to navigate the political environment. They're not stepping away from the work itself. And that is deeply encouraging to me because they understand there's no business that you have in the United States of America that is not going to have to engage with the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. There just isn't. There's no company that you can run with any seriousness that doesn't factor in how women are engaged in this environment, how people of color are advanced or disadvantaged in this space, how you engage with disability, how you engage with age. You know, like these are issues that are not going anywhere. So good leaders are, I won't lie, they're panicked because they basically feel vilified for having their own values for their own organization. And that's another piece of this that's really interesting. Like, if you decide that you don't want to lean into these things, fine. But the pursuit and the antagonistic hostility that's directed towards people who want to run their company their way is really unusual. This is a big switch from the people who preach about small government and free markets. You know, if a good leader has ascertained that they've got to make sure that they address these issues of inclusion in order to have a great workforce, well-being, productivity, performance, then who are you to come along and tell them they can't do that? So right now, leaders are trying to figure out what that looks like and what the reinvention of this space is, and taking lessons from the past, what the opportunities are to do things better, but also realizing the hostility of the environment and the intensity around maintaining the status quo. And it's very hard to see this as anything other than maintaining a racist, sexist status quo, right? Like it's basically an attack on difference. We're purging people simply because they don't look a certain way. People are being removed from positions. It's like McCarthy all over again, right? And so how do you navigate political intervention in business at this level? I think everybody's scrambling and trying to figure it out.
What do you make of later in the hour, we're going to have a conservative think tank on, and they posted an article about the idea of desperate impact. So the idea that, you know, just treat everyone the same. Is that possible?
I think I'm trying to find a kind word. I think it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I think that the reality is you have a specific harm, so you need a specific remedy. I don't treat all cancers the same. I don't treat all illnesses the same because if you have a different set of factors, realities, you know, men don't need a breastfeeding station, right? We're not all the same. We have these realities. And I'm always struck by this. I think it's really interesting because, you know, I've consulted with some of the biggest business schools in the world and think tanks, and they're all figuring out how to arrange variables in order to optimize success. And so now we have this school of thought of like, let's just eliminate all the variables. Let's act like no variables exist, right? And then we'll all be okay. We won't be okay. We will be like we were in 1945, like we were in 1933. These are not times that I aspire to go back to. I think that we evolve and we get better, not return to a time where there was mass inequity, right? And the thing about this that's really interesting is we're so selective in how we apply this. I'm thinking about the lawsuit against Harvard around emissions. So they went after affirmative action that really addressed the tiniest of percentage of applicants, if we're being really honest. But there was no lawsuit about legacy admissions and how the standards are lowered significantly for 40% of the applicants, 40%. So it's a much bigger group of people, but they weren't interested in addressing that inequity. So that's the thing I'm talking about. It's like, this is so selective, it's so obvious, and I kind of want to say, honey, we see you. We see you. We see what you're doing. We see the effort here. And again, I want to go on record. Any effort can be improved, right? And I'm here for it. Do you have suggestions? Do you have ideas? But the idea that we're just going to ignore them all and maintain the literal caste system that we have developed in the United States is just ridiculous. And it's really funny to me. There's so many examples. I think about J.D. Vance, for example, growing up in an incredibly low-income environment, right? I want him as a veteran to have an opportunity to go to Yale or to go to any Ivy League school. I want that for him. Why doesn't he want that for me? Right? That's what we're talking about. Creating opportunities that if you have the giftedness, you will have the access. And I reject any school of thought that is going to put a limit on that.
Well, I think, Denise, I could talk to you all day, but we are out of time for this segment. So thank you to Denise Hamilton, DEI expert and founder and CEO of Watch Her Work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Denise's book is Indivisible: How to Forge Our Differences into a Stronger Future. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of DEI programs in this country. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs exploded in the aftermath of the 2020 protests following the murder of George Floyd. Companies and universities added DEI offices and staff and poured money into training and promoted a top-down culture of acceptance. The Trump administration in its first week pulled the plug on these initiatives and scrubbed words from websites and also threatened to pull federal funding from universities that didn't comply. In Ohio, Republican lawmakers are pushing a sweeping and controversial higher education bill called Senate Bill 1 that would prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion in recruiting, training, and the offering of new scholarships. So, how are we supposed to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion now? Joining us is Ohio State University history professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Welcome back to All Sides.
Great to be with you, Amy.
So before we talk about what's happening right now with these DEI initiatives, let's do some historical perspective. When did DEI programs begin? Because it wasn't just 4 or 5 years ago after George Floyd's murder.
No, you're right. 4 or 5 years ago after the murder, we saw an expansion, an explosion, as you mentioned, of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. But diversity, equity, and inclusion is really an extension of affirmative action programs. Programs and policies that were designed in the wake of the civil rights movement in the 1960s to address the historic discrimination, to remove the barriers that have prevented African Americans specifically, but also other groups, including women, from participating fully in the public and private sector. And so we can trace the current initiatives back to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited federally discrimination in public accommodations, which gives us Title IX, which recognizes that women need to have full access and be able to participate in the realm of higher education equally and fully in all activities. And then over the years, it evolved. But it evolved in part because it was always under attack. And so we saw affirmative action being rolled back and being attacked. In other words, programs designed to address past grievances through the 1970s. You have the Bakke decision, and which dealt specifically with admissions to higher education, medical schools. But then through the 80s and the 90s, and then in early 2000s, we saw, again, a focus on college admissions and limiting the use of race in determining, as a determining, not a determining factor, but as one factor, background. And so there was a shift away from policies and programs to address past grievances and ongoing discrimination to diversity. Right. Diversity was supposed to be that which was palatable to political conservatives, that which was palatable to those. How could anybody be against diversity and inclusion and making sure we live in an equitable world? Well, apparently it has become that. And so after the explosion of these programs to promote inclusiveness, beginning certainly after the George Floyd largest protest in American history, we have seen this pushback, this backlash in response to that particular moment where we saw these programs be expanding. And that's where we find ourselves today.
As a history professor, do you see the actions of the Trump administration in the elimination of DEI, threatening federal funding if you still have those words on your website? Does that mimic any other time in history?
I don't know if it so much mimics as it is an as it is a part of. I don't think we can separate out what we're seeing now from what we've seen in the past as a response to efforts by African Americans and others to create a more democratic, more inclusive society. So there's never a point in American history where we as Americans just have just stopped saying, like, oh, we're opposed to these things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's welcome. There's always been pushback. I mean, there was pushback against the 1964 Civil Rights Act before it was signed, the moment it was signed, and ever since it has been signed. And so what we see now, this targeting specifically of diversity, equity, inclusion programs that are being racialized in a particular way, not talking about the fact that women and white women in particular, the primary beneficiaries, veterans are primary beneficiaries, but it's been racialized in a way, the code language coded so that it draws on the power of racism as a political organizing tool to rally support. What we're seeing now isn't really a critique of programs. What we're seeing is a political agenda that's being forced upon the American people, and it's being raced because the Trump administration understands the power of racism in organizing its base.
What do you make of, like, the alphabet soup, the word soup here, where people are just anti these words, diversity, equity, inclusion? And are the words just going to change? So maybe back, you know, years ago, people didn't like the words affirmative action or just didn't like the word civil rights became villainized. So now the words DEI are villainized. So we're going to come up with new words. I hear the word belonging coming up here and there.
And soon belonging is going to be a problem as well. Mm-hmm. And we have to, I mean, one of the things is the topic of the conversation. How do we talk about this?
We just change the words, right?
We just change the words and then they come after those words, right?
Yeah.
And so it was, and it's not even the words, right? Because it's CRT, not critical race theory, right? Mm-hmm. It's DEI. But we should be talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Are you actually opposed to diversity, right? Or this mythic thing called DEI? So part of the political propaganda is to take an acronym, right? And then use that as a political tool, right? And define it in your own particular ways. And that's what we're seeing right now. So we've seen it in the past, and we will see it going forward. So, you know, right now, you know, DEI is a substitute for CRT, which is a substitute for affirmative action, which was a substitute for the N-word. Like, we understand where the use of this language, where it takes us and what it's actually coded to mean.
So last week, the Ohio Senate passed what's called Senate Bill 1. It's a higher education bill, a sweeping, controversial bill that has hundreds of opponents lobbying and protesting. It still needs to pass the House, and it still needs to be signed by the governor, so the bill does have a long way to go. But a provision in the bill deals with DEI and how universities will stand to lose federal funding. There were two DEI leaders who exited their roles at Ohio State. Can you talk about the type of work that they were engaged in here at Ohio State, and, you know, what it means for them to have stepped down from their roles?
You know, Ohio State has been a leader for decades, going back to the legendary Hale has been a leader in creating a welcoming, open, diverse, inclusive environment here at the Ohio State University here on campus, both in terms of expanding admissions, but then creating programs to make sure that the students, the wonderful students that we admit, are given the tools and the protections not just to survive at Ohio State, but to succeed at Ohio State. We've been a champion of this. And to see us now moving away from that, bending the knee preemptively, without any sort of pushback or fight, is deeply troubling and terribly problematic, because it is clear that this is politics designed or framed as sort of, you know, productive policy. And, you know, even with our esteemed new president, you understand what diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are. So don't pretend that you don't. And the fact that you are not leading the charge as the president of the flagship university is deeply disturbing. And to continue to punt on the issues when it comes up publicly, I mean, if Ryan Day punted as much as Ted Carter, we would have fired him long ago, right? So either don't pretend like you don't know what this is, because then that's incompetence. Don't pretend like you can't fight and stand up for this, because then that's cowardice if you don't. And if you agree with this and are pretending that you don't, then you are being complicit. And so I stand with the students and my students in my classes and faculty who are saying this is not just rolling back. This is an infringement upon freedom of speech. This is you are advocating miseducation, and nobody in higher education, nobody in education, period, should be on the side of miseducation.
Now, Ted Carter sent an email to all staff. I'm a staff member of Ohio State University, so I got the same email you got, that he's still looking at it and investigating it. It didn't, like, say, per se, that he was eliminating all of this.
That's a punt. That's a punt. You know what it is. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be Mr. Military, right? You're the admiral of the ocean sea, right? Like, what are you doing? Right. Don't punt on this. Stand up for it. You know, this is about making a campus that is strong, that is better. One Buckeye Nation. Out of our diversity, we draw our strength. So we need you to stand up and fight for it publicly. There's nothing else
going
to
down
look
to
at.
The state house testifying.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Going out to the state. Look, and then you hear, well, we're afraid. We don't want to get sued. What are you afraid of? Ohio State gets sued all the time. Right. How about you stand and make sure that you're on the right side of history? That's what we need from our leadership.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Is diversity a forbidden topic now if you receive federal funding? And with us is Ohio State University Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries. So as a history professor, are you preparing to, like this federal directive or soon to be passed state law, how is it going to impact the way you teach?
I'm not changing a darn thing, because what's being asked of me in terms of what I teach courses on civil rights history. I teach courses on electoral politics. I teach courses on contemporary issues of race and racism and inequality and sexism and capitalism. So I cannot, you know, if we look at Senate Bill 1 and what it's being asked of the sort of policing in the curriculum, if you want me not to teach that, then you want me to teach a version of America's past and present that doesn't simply exist. And I absolutely refuse to go into the classroom and miseducate our students. So, you know, in the classroom, there's nothing for me to change. Either I walk in front of a class and I just stand there and look at them and say nothing, or I continue to do what I was brought here to do some 20 years ago, and that is to teach hard and uncomfortable truths, but the truth as plainly as I see it.
Now, in the past, protests have been a powerful mechanism for change. Are they still effective when all the levers of power, we're talking the president, Congress, the courts, are all leaning more conservative? And here at the State House, the governor's office, there's a supermajority in the legislature here in Ohio. Are protests still powerful enough?
That's what we have. And that's what we have to rely on. History tells us that protest is powerful. It's a deep part of the American tradition. Whether you're dumping tea in the Boston Harbor or you're crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, history tells us, and American history tells us, that it doesn't take a lot of people to make a big difference. And when the people demand to be on the right side of history, when the people demand that we expand our democracy, when the people demand that we make America more welcoming so that all people can achieve their fullest potential, then we have to stand up for that. And if our elected leaders, if our administrators, whether we're talking about universities or we're talking about corporations, refuse to do that, then the people will do it themselves. We are the ones who have to lead this charge, and we will do it. And if we do not, you know, sort of students take to the streets and protest and have their voices heard, it may not win. We may lose this round, but there will be another round and we will keep fighting.
Now, on social media, there's this big push for an economic protest. February 28th is called Economic Blackout. And it's being targeted as a boycott of companies that have ended their DEI program. They're telling people don't go shop at these companies. Will that work?
Not just one day, right? But it's good. It's good to show. I mean, economic boycotts have also been a part of the great protest, nonviolent protest tradition in American history. I drove by Target the other day, and I did a slow drive-by and looked inside to see how many black folk were not in there, right? And so the word is spreading. People are unhappy with this, right? It's only a small group who are using this to divide Americans, using this issue to divide Americans, when what Americans across the spectrum actually want is unity, to come together. And these are programs designed to help us understand each other, right? To make it more accessible, make the university more accessible for everyone, regardless of their background or past circumstances. And that's what people are saying that we want, whether it's in higher education, whether it's in politics in the federal government, or whether it's in corporate America.
And shortly after the Trump administration had their directive on DEI, the Air Force, as an example, removed videos of the Tuskegee Airmen and the Women's Air Force Service pilots, the first black and female Air Force pilots. They removed their videos. And then there was an uproar, mm-hmm. and the videos were put back up. So what do you make of this? It's like a ping-ponging back and forth of who wins.
Well, I don't even know if it's a ping-ponging, right? I mean, it's the direction is so – people are being terrorized, right, by this particular political movement to scrub American history of sort of what actually happened. So, you know, it's not just about sort of, you know, policy and programs. It's like, well, we want to erase the difficult parts of America's past. The Tuskegee Airmen are heroes. They are American heroes. And we can't just simply talk about them as being heroes without talking about their experiences. But now we're saying we're just not going to talk about them. You know, the previous guest, when she was talking about that the painting that was being painted over, mm-hmm. of core characteristics, that was at Quantico. Right. I mean, you know, erasing, saying that we're not going to focus on not just inclusivity, but honesty, respect. I mean, that's what we're saying. So, no, if that's what you want to whitewash, to erase America's past because you're made uncomfortable by the difficult things that actually happened, then that is not something that we as Americans will stand for. Our children have to understand the past so they can make sense of the present. And when you begin to scrub American history like that, we do our children a disservice and we do the American people a disservice.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what about the federal laws against discrimination in the workplace? I mean, is this still, it's a federal law. Is this still a guardrail? If companies do revert to non-DEI practices and stop using diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, do we have federal laws as a fallback?
One of the things that diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and policies did, not only opening the door for people to come in, they helped keep universities and companies and corporations in compliance with federal law. It was their guardrail. This is how you stay in compliance with Title IX. This is how you stay in compliance with these things. So once you start to unroll that, I guarantee that guardrail, once that guardrail is gone, we're going to step over it. So if you are worried about lawsuits because of the existence of diversity programs, wait till the lawsuits start coming because you've violated federal law. You violated the 1964 Civil Rights Act. You violated the American with Disabilities Act of 1990. Then you're really going to have some lawsuits. So you can prevent that now. let's get ahead of the curve and be on the right side of history so you don't have to worry about those lawsuits because they're coming, and stop being worried about some lawsuits by two or three people because they want to advance the agenda of a couple of mediocre white men.
We're going to have to end it there, but I want to say thank you to history professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a researcher from a conservative think tank about his views on DEI. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs exploded in the aftermath of the 2020 protests following George Floyd's murder. Companies and universities have added DEI offices and staff and poured money into training to promote a top-down culture of acceptance. The Trump administration, in its first week, pulled the plug on DEI initiatives, scrubbed the words from websites, and threatened to pull federal funding from universities that didn't comply. So, how are we supposed to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion now? Joining us is Greg Lawson, a research fellow at the Buckeye Institute, a conservative think tank. Welcome back to All Sides, Greg.
Great to be back. Thank you very much.
So the Trump administration has vowed to create a colorblind, merit-based society, ending DEI programs. So from your perspective, how have DEI programs been problematic?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing is, I think if you hear the goals that are articulated, whether you agree with individual decisions that are being made or not, I think you look at the goals first. Are we trying to be as colorblind society and meritocratic? Is that sort of what the United States wants? Is that going back even to, you know, some of the things when we think of Martin Luther King sort of talking a lot about looking at people being judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin? I think that is something that intuitively Ohioans, Americans writ large, definitely understand and agree with. So fast forward here to some of the concepts. I think when we talk about diversity, we talk about including people, I think that's something that we have been trying to move forward towards for a very, very long time, and long before there was sort of this industry that sort of has emerged to do things. Now, that doesn't mean everything was perfect. Doesn't mean that there wasn't still more work to be done. But I think that what you have seen is a little bit of an industry that has popped up, and an awful lot of money has been spent to accomplish things. And in some cases, there may be some positive things that have developed, but I think a lot of people are very concerned that what really has happened is that we have shifted from that goal of being colorblind and looking at the merit and the content of individuals, and more towards explicit sort of quota kind of requirements, things where we start to not look at, the actual what is the person able to do, irrespective of any particular background that individual might have. And is that creating challenges and problems? And is that really adhering to what we think of as the American ideal? I think that is something that has been, you know, obviously very controversial in recent years. I think what there's an effort to do here is to return to a more sort of traditional understanding, not an understanding that tries to ignore things, not to ignore injustices that have happened, not to ignore being very broad-based and welcoming to people. In fact, diversity is indeed a strength. Diversity is a strength when we look at diversity as a means to the end of strength, the strength of being able to be a unified nation and a unified culture, so to speak, or at least as much as possible. But when you look at it as an end, maybe, rather than in and of itself, as opposed to that means, I think that is where people started to have some concerns about it. And I think that's where a lot of the stuff flows from the policy standpoint in Washington. Obviously, I've spoken again on this show, I think, before about Senate Bill 1 and some of the variable things that are contained in there and what we need to do in higher education. So I think what we're trying to see is a resetting and an understanding that this actually is very consistent with a historical understanding of what America is in, and not just going back like 200 years, but in the post-civil rights era as well.
So do you feel, our last guest talked about it was the Civil Rights Act, and then it was affirmative action, and now it's DEI. Do you feel like it is just a renaming of the same thing, or do you feel like DEI in and of itself in the past few years has gone too far?
I think that when we think about the Civil Rights era and we think about the Civil Rights Act and the things that, and all the very wonderfully beneficial things that have happened, there was more to do. I think it's how we have integrated this, how we talk about this. You know, it has become, unfortunately, and I think it's become this way a little bit on both sides, right? Politicized. And it's hard sometimes for things where people get very emotional, not
a little bit politicized. I have to say, I mean, a lot of it. Don't say a little bit. No.
But I think that it's fair to say that it's been politicized on both sides. I don't think this is something where one side is all responsible for this and the other side doesn't have a role to play. In fact, when you really think about it, usually when issues get very hot like this, what you find is that two sides, really two extreme sides, tend to sort of wrestle with each other, and what you end up with is sort of they symbiotically get related to each other. They almost need each other for the other side to exist because they act in opposition to each other. And I think we've seen a little bit of that, unfortunately, happening. And I think the broad majority of Americans, you know, that a lot of folks who are kind of keeping their head down, doing what they do, pretty much feel like, boy, can't we all, you know, I mean, get along, as we've heard that before in this context, obviously. Rodney King even said that at one point in time, of course. And I think that is what people really want to see happen. So, you know, I know there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of emotion that's out there. But there's also constitutional issues, jurisprudence issues. We know we've seen recent cases out of the Supreme Court that deal with things like admissions policies for universities. There was the Fair Admissions versus Harvard case back, I think, in 2023, so a relatively recent case. That really kind of did go after affirmative action. But it didn't necessarily mean that you can't still talk about diversity. It doesn't mean that you still can't reach out to various communities. It doesn't mean that you can't reach out to people who have low incomes and socioeconomic challenges, whether that's urban folks or whether that's rural folks in Appalachia. Those things are not foreclosed upon at all as a result of the Supreme Court case. Those things would not be foreclosed on at all as a result of Senate Bill 1 passing. Those things would not be foreclosed on really at all, even under some of the things that are coming down from the Trump administration. So I think when we pull the lens back and, you know, we strip away some of the rhetoric that both sides have engaged in, I think we can see a very, you know, frankly, moderate path to being sure that we're welcoming to everybody. And I think that ultimately that's where we want to get to societally, because that's really where the unity comes from.
Now, the moderate path doesn't feel very moderate when you're threatening federal funding, right? Because that is what is having a chilling effect for a lot of people, where if they don't eliminate these DEI words from their website, if they don't let go DEI staff, they will lose federal funding. That hits people very close to home.
Well, I'll flip that, though, and say that there was a point in time where we were using federal funding to essentially mandate that you have to have programs that meet certain kind of criteria. And they were, you had, in order to get the money, you had to do this. So, you know, I could see the point that's being raised there, but it does kind of run a little bit both ways. And we can have an argument whether or not, you know, and there's an argument about private sector actors and, you know, freedom of speech. And I think that's something we need to be cognizant of and pay attention to. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about things like we're putting taxpayer money in, we want to make sure the taxpayer money is getting a return on investment. I think we spoke about this when we were talking about higher education and how we fund higher education. How do we make sure that we're getting people employed? How do we make sure that when the tax dollars are going into something, that we're getting something directly as a result of it, and not just funding things that may or may not have some sort of a long-term benefit? We need to be very, especially with the national debt we have, we need to be very focused on return on investment. We're talking about government programs and government funding. Now, when we're talking about private sector folks, that's a little bit of a different story. And we need to kind of draw a little bit of a line there, because those are two things. You really can't, nor should you, impose any sort of a litmus test one way or the other on actors, individuals in terms of what they can say, or private companies in terms of what they can do. But for the folks that are criticizing, saying that this is taking away those rights, mm-hmm. I would argue that when you were imposing and saying you only get the money if you do this, in a certain sense, that was an imposition as well.
Now, regarding the federal you know, funding, but then also in the private sector. So in the private sector, I'm going to use Target as an example. So Target eliminated DEI programs, you know, and with the timing, you have to say it was in response to all of this. They're a private company. So what do you make of, you know, why Target?
Well, again, though, I think that this is a two-edged sword, because I think you can look at it and say that it also, some organizations created it because there was a lot of political pressure and a lot of discussion and a lot of federal, well, maybe federal, maybe state, various pressure points. For example, but not everybody is eliminating. I know that, you know, I mean, I've heard, you know, certainly they are one that's kind of prominent. But if it's my understanding,
Costco's keeping it.
But that's about what I was about to say, is Costco, which is a very large company, too, does a lot of work. Now, are there going to be, I heard the previous guest, and you asked a question about, you know, boycotts and economic boycotts and things like that. Look, if there's a boycott and people want to do this on a private basis and they want to organize and they want to do it, they certainly have the right to do it and they will do it. And if private companies feel that that is, you know, harming their bottom line, frankly, which is what a lot of them are having to deal with, then they will adjust in accordance with that. But you had that. You had people who didn't like some of the programs occasionally would, you know, try to get online and create, you know, a social maelstrom, so to speak, in order to go about it. And so that is American free speech in action, and the private companies are going to be responding. And I will say, I think in a sense, that some of these actions by the private companies, is there an impact from what, you know, the new administration in Washington is doing? I think there's an impact. But I think there's also an impact that this has been not a clear-cut, unvarnished success. A lot of companies have had challenges because of some of the different kinds of programs that they've implemented under that particular banner of the DEI banner. And I think that some companies have realized that the private market actors, consumers, are making choices that don't necessarily correspond to that. And so I think there's also a little bit of an action towards responding to the market. So I think it's a little bit of both that's happening simultaneously.
The Buckeye Institute wrote recently about an idea known as the disparate impact theory, or disparate. I always have a hard time with that word. But anyway, it called for the Trump administration to end this if he's serious about ending DEI. So can you explain that theory?
Sure. It really comes back from a case in the early 1970s. And what it basically was there was a company that was, I think, some kind of an industrial company that had basically tests to ensure, we had to have a high school diploma, I believe, and you had to pass a certain type of test of cognitive function in order to, because basically if you're not capable, you could get injured, you could get hurt. There was a basic level of, we need to make sure people can follow the rules and do the various things. Now, everybody had to take this. This was not specifically to any group. There was a case that was brought to the, and it ultimately went up to the Supreme Court, and ultimately what it found was that these particular tests, even though they were broadly applied to any applicant, it ended up with a disproportionate number of African Americans that would ultimately not pass. Thus, they could not then be employed at that employer. And thus, there was a disparate impact on those individuals. Now, unlike things that we have seen that were clearly, you know, the Jim Crow and the very obviously terrible things that have happened historically, those were obviously very much targeted to have an express purpose to target individual groups. That's why they're wrong. That's why we got rid of them eventually, fortunately, and that's what the Civil Rights Act is all about, making sure that we don't do those kind of things again. These other things, but this is where it gets murkier in terms of how reality actually operates. Can you have a standard that can have an impact that impacts different groups of people differently, but it's still the same standard? So you're not creating different standards for different people in order to target people. You're creating a standard for everybody because there's a basic level of whatever it is that you need in order to perform a particular function. Well, what happened with that case because of that is it started to filter out into a lot of layers of the private sector, how the government started to look at things. And we started to see a lot of businesses act in ways where they're saying, well, I can't do this. I can't have this. So what am I going to do in order to make sure I'm able to hire people that can do the job and things like that? Mm-hmm. So you started to see a reverberation effect where college degrees, jobs that didn't used to have a college degree, started to get a college degree because it was essentially a sorting mechanism, because you couldn't do that. You couldn't do essentially the competency-based test because that might run afoul of a disparate impact. So now we're going to do this, and that way we can avoid calling it that. But in effect, it sort of was a way to weed things out. And so we started to see that, you know, that kind of isn't the only reason, but that leads to one of the problems that we talked about previously about higher education costs, student debt, things like that, because we inflated credentials partly to resolve some of these things. So it has had a very pernicious effect. There have been examples in, I think it was Minnesota, where landlords essentially were suing regulations on health and safety and things like rodent control and things like that, because they were saying, what you're doing by making me do all this is you're making me have to spend more money to do these things. Thus, it's making me have to make rent higher in order to compensate me for the cost of complying with regulations. And then, because of that, it's being having a disproportionate impact on lower income folks who tended to be perhaps minorities.
All right, so we're running out of time. But so you're saying the Trump administration needs to, as an example, get rid of the qualification of, like, to get this federal job, you have to have a college degree if we're going to be equal for in everything. Right.
Well, yeah. Basically, what we really want to have, and the real bottom line of this entire message, and the thing that I guess I'd love folks to understand, is what we want is broad based. For everybody looking at it and not picking based upon individual characteristics, but basing again on things like content to character capabilities. How we resolve all of that, there's a lot in education, lots of other policies we need to talk about, but I don't think the DEI is targeted appropriately to accomplish those ends.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Greg Lawson, research fellow with the Buckeye Institute, a conservative think tank. Thank you for joining us. This has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.